This is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. I'm here today with Vanessa Winship. She's one of the UK's probably best loved photographers. I can't say that, can I? Maybe I can. I don't know. She recently was a recipient of the Henri Cartier-Bresson Award, was the first woman to get that honour. She's won a couple of World Press Awards. She won Sony Photographer of the Year Award. She won Taylor Wessing...
Godfrey Argent.
Godfrey Argent Prize for the best, I think, black and white image. She's published... three books, plus the catalogue for her recent retrospective. Hi, Vanessa.
Hello, Ben.
Call me traditional, but I want to start with your early experiences with photography. How did you discover it?
I guess I didn't consciously discover it, although... basically, I loved pictures. I loved photographs. As a child, when I went to visit my grandma, they would sit me in front of the writing bureau with a pile of old family pictures, and I could just spend hours and hours looking at them in my own childish way, imagining and wondering who that was and where it was. But later, actually... becoming a photographer, and again, I don't even know whether I was thinking consciously about becoming a photographer, but I bought my first camera when my son was, I think, nearly 5 months old. So I don't have any images of him at all before that time. And I guess for me, it was a question of recording this new life.
Yeah, that was a time when it wasn't like everyone had iPhones in those days. It was like if you didn't have, you know, if someone didn't have a camera, you weren't going to have those images.
No, exactly.
So you, yeah, either you get your own or someone else has to have one. And that, so, yeah, and you became a mother very young. You were only, what, 20 years old or something?
19.
Right.
Almost 20.
How did that then lead into you pursuing photography?
Well, I'd gone very briefly to art college, but I think I was sort of out of my depth there. And during that time, there was a photography module, and it was at that time when I sort of picked up a camera.
How out of your depth? How so?
I think that I'd gone there with a very naive idea of what art was, and I guess I didn't even really understand what art was, what is art. Mm. And so I'd gone there being able to draw things in detail, drawings of flowers, and at art college it was much more about sort of being expressive in this sort of expansive way, which just wasn't really me. But there was this module of photography that seemed to make sense to me. And I guess that's how I first sort of dipped into it. And then after my son was born, we moved with my then partner to Bristol, and I decided that I was going to retake my A-levels because I'd failed on my A-levels. And so I took a photography module there and another art module. And basically that was my entry into photography, and I just became really obsessed with it. And I guess the people that I was looking at were people like Edward Weston, Walker Evans, Joseph Kadelka, a lot of American photography. But at that time it was just books. There was no internet. Mm. And so in a way we were limited to the kind of preferences of the teachers who were around us.
Right. What lit you up about it, do you think, though?
I think it was just being able to record something that seemed special. So for me, it was my son. And in a way, it sort of sounds like you become a photographer automatically, but you don't. I mean, I really wasn't sort of thinking, now I'm a photographer. It was just something that I did.
Yeah. But I mean, a lot of people get into taking pictures of their babies and they don't necessarily want to take it any further than that, or they don't even think about themselves as photographers, but you were clearly thinking about it beyond just family snaps. Or not. What?
I can't remember.
Okay. What was your experience of art college? You've talked quite a lot about, you know, your kind of small town origins, I suppose.
Yeah.
Did you have that sort of desire to escape that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I guess my first escape, if you like, was actually going over to the art college, which was in Hull, which is a city. And so, I don't know, I think perhaps the images of my father from when he was in the army made me think that there was something beyond the little sort of one horse town that I was from. So I guess even though I didn't fit into the art college, it was a first step for me for being outside of, yeah, that little world that I'd come from, really.
Were you rebellious?
I don't know whether I was rebellious or whether I meant to be rebellious, but I think I just was. I think that I somehow never fitted into the sort of normal things that people did.
Mm. I mean, becoming a mother at that young, even then, would have been presumably fairly unusual. That in itself could be construed as rebellious.
Maybe it could be seen as being rebellious, but actually, if I think about it, in my little town, there were many people having children early. It was probably seen as the norm.
Right.
So maybe I wasn't at all rebellious and was just fitting into
expectations.
What people did in small towns.
Yeah, but it seems like you were pretty keen to get out of there.
Yeah, no, I was really desperate to leave. I mean, it's a great place to grow up when you're a child, but I think once you hit your teens, you really begin to, or I certainly did, begin to sort of recognise the limitations of
that life.
Of that life, yeah.
And photography was your route out.
Yeah, I think it was.
Mm. So you ended up in London doing a photography degree. How was that for you? Did you get anything out of that which has sort of stayed with you?
Yeah, the thing that stayed with me is George. He's
your husband.
My husband.
Yes, you got him out of it. That's a good point. Well, that in a way has been incredibly important. I've spoken to the aforementioned George for this podcast. Yeah, you met George, you were on the same course together.
We were on the same course together. No, I mean, it was, for me, it was this girl, really, because I still sort of think that I probably was a girl, was in London, and it's, you know, it's the big city. And so it wasn't simply about photography. It was also about how it is to live in a big city.
Mm. And he was a sort of London boy, so he seemed like, did he seem like he sort of knew his way around?
Yeah, no, I mean, George was very confident and, yeah, he knew London back to front.
This is George Giorgio we're talking about, by the way, in case any of the listeners aren't aware of the fact that you guys are married, and he's also a photographer. You've always done stuff together from that moment on, in a way.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think our last 2 years at college, we spent our time photographing together and photographing one another. I think we probably became really boring, and that's what we ended up doing.
Yeah,
solipsistic. Looking at ourselves.
But you know, you've managed to do something which, from the outside at least, seems remarkable, which is that you have pursued your own photographic projects whilst basically travelling together. How have you managed to do that?
I don't know, really. I mean, I think it's it's difficult really to answer that question, because we've just sort of muddled along together. And I think, I don't know, I guess it's that in many ways we share a lot of things that we like. It's about sharing things that you like, really.
And sharing each other's company. And photography is can be a very solitary and very lonely endeavor. Wouldn't you agree?
I think it is, but I also think that idea of the sort of lone wolf is something of a myth, because I think even photographers who travel alone are often with a translator or somebody who's a local person.
Sure, yeah, but it's not quite the same as being with, you know, being back home with, you know, wife and kids kind of thing. It's a different type of dynamic.
Yeah.
And you are essentially out there doing your own thing. Obviously, like you say, it's kind of a cliche, it doesn't necessarily apply. But for you and George, you've sort of managed to avoid that entire issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's, we trust one another. We share the same politics, I think. We're curious about the same things. We're interested in people, I think, in the same way, what's happening in the world.
You can give each other feedback, and you respect each other's opinions photographically, so you've always got someone there to sort of bounce ideas off.
Yeah, no, I think that I'm incredibly lucky that I do have that possibility. I mean, when we're working away, I mean, I still work with film, and George works digitally, and so when he's working, we can basically go back at night and look over what he's done and almost begin the sort of whole editing process. And so he has an idea of what he has, and in a way I can sort of benefit from that seeing, if you like.
Mm. After your degree, what did you do after that? You eventually went and did a postgraduate photojournalism course.
Yeah, quite a number of years afterwards. I think it's maybe even 10 years afterwards, I ended up doing a postgraduate certificate in photojournalism. And I suppose that was, in a way, it was partly a reaction to the kind of work we were doing at the Polytechnic of Central London, which was very much kind of about staged imagery, more conceptual work, and very, very anti-documentary in its own way. And so I think that I wanted to sort of reground myself in, I suppose, broadly speaking, documentary.
That's what was interesting to you at that point.
At that point, it was what I wanted to sort of reach back to, because I suppose if I think about my early influences, I mean, although I said Edward Weston, I think it was very much more connected to the document.
What did you get from that course? Because in a way, you were already at a level beyond.
Yeah, I mean, when I arrived to the course, I realised that I was actually, in terms of experience, sort of head and shoulders above other people in terms of what I knew photographically. And I already knew how to piece together an essay. But again, it's much more about life in a way, and I guess what I really got from that course was I made some friends.
Right, yeah. Again, including me.
Again, yes, including you. Yeah, no, I mean, it really was about being in a similar boat again to people who shared the same passion, the same desire to explore the world around them.
Yeah, so really, yeah, it was more about kind of getting your head in the right place again,
It was about in a way, I think we're all searching for community, and I think perhaps over and above all the theory, it really is about community. If I have anything to say, I think it's about community.
Why do you think that's of such interest to you?
Because I think it's a fundamental desire that we have, a desire to find our place within the world.
Hmm.
We're all searching for our own home.
And for connection with other people.
And for connection with other people, certainly.
Yeah, and a lot of your work does definitely seems to reflect that. After you'd done that postgraduate course, I mean, you're very much, I think, within the kind of documentary, black and white, mm-hmm. almost Magnum style approach. You went to the Balkans. What took you there? I think it was Albania that you were interested in.
Yeah, no, I'd seen a picture of Albania that didn't really correspond with the images of poverty and you know, this images that were coming from mainstream media, and yeah, I guess I became fascinated by this place that was right in the middle of Europe, and yet, unlike Italy and Greece, I knew nothing about. And so I became sort of obsessed with this funny little obscure backwater place that had basically been sort of hidden for more than 50 years. And then I joined the Albanian Society to try and find out more, because, of course, it was before the internet and it was before travel was easy. And I learned about Albania, I learnt about its most famous writer, Ismail Kadare, whose work I read. And then, of course, through learning little snippets about Albania, I also learnt about Kosovo and the Albanians who lived in Kosovo. And so I guess when the conflict happened there, it was really the time to go to discover who these Albanians were and right. what that landscape looked like.
So that was sheer coincidence in a way that you were thinking about that part of the world when all that happened.
It I just makes so. Sense. I guess so.
But were you interested in covering that conflict as a sort of from a kind of reportage point of view, or was it more or less an excuse to go and start something about
it? I think it was continuing the exploration of understanding what it was about that place. It was our excuse to go and to understand.
What was your experience of Kosovo like in terms of covering a fairly sort of photojournalistic story, you know, in a way that perhaps you hadn't done before?
Yeah, no, it was a completely alien thing to me. I mean, I'd never been, as you say, I'd never been into anything like that before, and we'd gone on under our own steam. We'd driven there ourselves, and all the way to the north of Albania, I was thinking to myself, what am I going to say? How am I going to function in this situation where people had lost lives, people had lost family, people had lost their homes, people were in this sort of desperate situation? How was I going to justify my presence there? And I think quite quickly, once we were at the actual border of between Albania and Kosovo, when people were actually coming over the border, there was a sense that what you were doing somehow meant to those people that they hadn't been forgotten, and that you were there. You were there to listen to them, if nothing else, almost. Yeah, that it seemed like it was almost a sort of catharsis for people to, you know, express what had happened to them.
How did you react to the sort of news gathering operation and the kind of conventions of doing that stuff? What was your kind of take on it?
It was really incredible. I mean, it really became, it sort of felt like a sort of machine it felt like a complete unfamiliar machine that.
Did you immediately feel that it was not something that you wanted to sort of be part of, ultimately, as a photographer?
Yeah, I think so, but I don't know whether I don't know whether that was really sort of really conscious right from the very beginning. I think it was only as the whole situation developed that I began to know that I wasn't part of that.
Mm. What happened after that for you then? Where did you go up next?
After that, we ended up going to Serbia as George had come in contact with a group of people in Albania who were from this small village, and he wanted to follow them back home when they eventually did go back home. And so when the NATO bombing was over, we ended up going into Kosovo, and it was very much, I guess, George's story kind of took over from that. And I don't know, I suppose the way we've always worked is that we've, maybe one of us is working whilst the other one's
supporting
as it were. Or understanding.
Yeah, that seems to have worked out very well for you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have to say that I'm not somebody who always carries a camera with me. I mean, I think I'm quite slow in understanding what's happening, and so I'm, most of the time, I'm not with a camera.
Hmm. Well, it's a sort of slightly more thoughtful approach in a way that you don't just start a project lightly, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know whether, very often people ask me what project I'm working on, and I don't really know what to say, because it's sometimes just about something or something that I feel that I want to explore, or something that's happened that I want to understand more. Or
your project from there really became the Black Sea project. It was a much bigger project in the end, because it took in a whole load of Black Sea countries.
Yeah, no, the Blacks, I mean, I was very fortunate in that I was put in contact with a publisher who publishes once a year a book about the sea, and I'd been working on this work around the Black Sea, and so I already had a body of work that sort of fitted their agenda.
And how long had it taken you to assemble that piece of work then?
I guess if I think about it, it was probably from 2002 to 2006.
Right.
So it was a number of years that I'd been sort of wandering around the Black Sea.
Yeah. And what was your overall impression? What were you trying to sort of say, as it were?
I guess I was interested in borders as an idea of what borders actually meant about the fragility of life, about how cultures are a sort of similar, how the sea is a place that divides people, but it also brings people together. About those histories, about stories that people had to tell.
Well, between chronicle and fiction is kind of part of what the title was. You talk about the fact that you're focusing on the junction between those two things. How did that sort of evolve in your mind as an idea?
It's really, it feels really complicated now to answer that question. But I suppose I was, as I say, I met with the writer Ismail Kadare, who was a fiction writer, and I was also very influenced by a journalist, historian, writer, Neil Asherson, whose work was very much based in actuality. And so I was, I guess, interested in those, how it is you can tell a story either in fiction, because Cardaray's work is very much about the region that he was brought up in and what was going on in that region. And he told that story in a fictional way, whereas Asherson's work was very much rooted in the telling of history.
Yeah, because as a documentary photographer, obviously, it's sort of almost the idea of allowing an element of fiction into the work is almost anathema, and yet you're sort of embracing that idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the idea of the truth is a really difficult thing for me to accept, because I think truth is always plural. There are many truths. There is not one single truth. It depends who's telling that history, I suppose. And I'm interested in as many voices that tell their own truth about their experience of the world they live in.
And, you know, working in black and white is in a way, you said before that it's a way of kind of almost emphasising that, the idea that the world is actually in colour, in case anyone hadn't noticed, and therefore black and white, although very much thought of as a kind of documentary, traditional, you know, medium, is not actually reflective of reality.
Yeah, I mean, the world is in colour. The world isn't in black and white. But of course, black and white, there are many shades of grey.
You also introduced the use of text, which I guess is also part of, I mean, some of the text that you used to capture the images was from Cardaray's work.
Some of the texts I used were little snippets from Cardaray. I think I used a couple of little quotes from Neil Asherson's Black Sea book. And then I used snippets of stories that I was told by people along the way. And there were also little snippets of thoughts that I had about what was happening.
Mm. How did you come by that as a sort of idea that you were going to use text that might not necessarily ordinarily accompany images?
No, I mean, I was frustrated by the sort of journalistic caption, "The cat sat on the mat," or "Who, why, what, where, when," although they're essential in journalistic work. I wanted to take the questions in a different direction, or open up the possibility of another layer of telling, if you like.
The Black Sea book was your first book. How did it feel to finally have a book published after working so hard for so long?
It was really important for me to actually put the work together as a book. It felt like the right place for the work. Whether the book actually fulfills my expectation, I'm not really sure. I mean, I think that my idea and the idea of the publisher weren't always the same, and so there was a sort of element of compromise that I guess I found frustrating.
Mm. As is often the case, I think, with...
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a real talent and a real skill to be a good publisher.
Mm. So once that was done, what did you have a sense of, what am I going to do now after, you know, working on that project for a long time? Or were you already on to the next thing?
I guess as the whole thing kind of works, is that I've finished this project, I need to find another one. It was more about what my experience of being somewhere had led me, what were the things that I felt were important, what I felt that I could do to express something about somewhere, about some people.
Mm.
And I think that the thing that took me was the schoolgirls in Turkey. And because I'd travelled so extensively with George, I'd seen almost every city in Turkey, and it was one of the sort of recurring images, I guess, in that vast landscape, seeing these kids kind of flitting around the country in their little blue dresses. And it happened to doing the work happened to coincide with a campaign to get more girls into schools, specifically rural girls into school. And why they don't go to school is vastly complicated. And to try to explain a little bit about why it's complicated, it's partly because of traditional values of not considering it important to educate girls. But I think more pertinently, it was about this sort of low-level conflict that has gone on within Turkey between the Kurds and the Turkish state. And so anything that represents the state was suspicious. And so there was a, one of the groups of people that didn't send their girls to school was the Kurdish community.
So this was what became Sweet Nothings, which was a, the project which, in a way, kind of started a lot off for you. It really resonated with people.
Yeah.
So you, I mean, first of all, there was a slight change of gear because you shot all that on medium, on, medium format or large format on 5.4.
Yeah.
How did that decision get made?
I guess I'm essentially I had been up until that point, a street photographer, working on the street, working quite silently, in fact, being invisible, not asking for permission to make an image. And permission's a really complex thing because, of course, as a street photographer, you're sort of looking for moments, if you like. And if you stop and ask everybody, then the moment's gone. But you know, and or certainly I know and understand when I've been given permission. But so it became, I became sort of uncomfortable with that whole issue with permission, the whole invisibility thing, the whole notion of photography changing something.
But it was the antithesis, in a way, to go to from that to a much more kind of slower way of working and a more considered way of working, and obviously a much more overt presence that you would be.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a question of the presence being about me as such, but it's about the acknowledgement of a presence or a third presence. So we have the connection between the subject, the person being photographed, the photographer, and then there's the third element, which is the audience. And so I wanted to address that idea of taking responsibility for your viewing, if you like.
What was it about these little girls that attracted you?
I think it was because of their position within society. I wanted to sort of somehow create a space to for them to have a sort of moment in the sun, if you like.
You know, at what point did you realize it was really gonna work as a set? Did you know pretty early on that it was gonna resonate? Because
no, I had absolutely no idea that that it was going to resonate with people in the way that it did. I mean, I felt it myself, but I didn't know whether the photographs would resonate what I
felt,
if you like.
Yeah, because it's funny you mentioned somewhere that when you were editing the work, it was quite emotional for you. You felt, you know.
Yeah,
really...
no, I mean, they really sort of took me by surprise.
I mean, the reason it's interesting from a personal point of view is that I remember when I first saw those pictures, and I had a very instantaneous, very kind of visceral reaction, because I kind of welled up, you know, it just made me want to cry immediately. And I thought, holy moly, you know, if that's not what photography is supposed to be about, then I personally don't know what is. I mean, you know, that's the kind of emotional response that I, you know, really hope for.
Yeah, no, I mean, they, I mean, it almost feels as though it was sort of nothing to do with me in a way. You know, it was really them.
No, but I don't know. I in a way, I think you were kind of born to shoot that project.
Maybe.
Because there is a sensitivity to your portraiture in particular, which is unmistakable. Do you sort of acknowledge, do you see that yourself? You must do.
I think that I've begun to acknowledge that there are certain things that I seem to be able to touch upon.
Yeah, there's something there. I don't think anyone else would have got the same results with the schoolgirls. And partly it's because you're a woman. Obviously that has an influence.
I think it really. I'm not suggesting that a man isn't sensitive enough to make that work. I think it would. Isn't necessarily a gender thing, but.
No, but the way in which the girls would have responded, you know, would have been very different. But it's far more than just the fact that you're a woman. There is something. You do bring a certain quality to. There's a certain melancholy.
Yeah, no, people have said that, and I think. I don't know whether that's a reflection of me.
Yeah, because, well, you have that element. You have that side to you, but anyone who knows you knows that that's only one, you know, that's only one part of it. You're not actually melancholy at all. You're actually not.
A barrel of laughs.
But you are quite funny, actually. No, but you are fun-loving, actually. And yeah, you know, obviously we're all more than one person. But that became Sweet Nothings, and it did get published as a little book, but it kind of worked as a little book, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it really needed to be that little exercise book, size book.
Mm.
I don't think it's twee or sugar-coated.
Mm.
I don't know. It just fitted with the work, I think.
Did it have an immediate impact as far as sort of putting you on the map goes? Because, you know, you and George also together had both, you know, been working your butts off for quite a long time, but you hadn't really got a great deal of recognition. Certainly there wasn't much financial reward from all that hard work.
I mean, I wasn't suddenly given assignments.
Right.
Maybe if I'd been more interested in pursuing work assigned, it would have been easier for me, having, you know, gained so much attention from the work, but I didn't pursue that. I guess I just carried on.
Hmm. But that seems to be where you're most, you know, you're most comfortable doing your own thing, and perhaps you're just not cut out for, you know, working for other people.
Yeah, but no, I really believe that there are people that really don't suit assignment work. You see, I think the thing is that I only pursue things up to a point in that respect. I think that I probably shy away in the end to sort of super success, because I think there are certain people who really know where they think they want to be going, and, you know, each step is a step up the ladder, and I don't know whether I feel that or whether that's even of interest to me.
Mm. Did it feel like you had finally got some recognition, perhaps, at that point that you hadn't until then had?
Yeah, no, for sure it was recognition, and I think we all need that. And it certainly did breathe life back into the work I'd made around the Black Sea. I mean, initially making the book was actually about wanting to give a present to the kids who were in the pictures.
Yeah.
But I think I was quite naive in that, thinking that a publisher can afford to give me X number of books for nothing. And of course, I couldn't afford to buy 100 books.
Right. But ultimately, you did give some.
But ultimately, I was able to find a publisher who was willing to give some books.
I guess the success of Sweet Nothings, you know, had all kinds of knock-on effects that you couldn't have anticipated. It did put you on the map, as it were, and a lot of people became aware of your work who might have not have been up until then, even though you'd been working away for 20 years or something prior to that. Mm. Maybe even the Henri Cartier-Bresson people, you know, were in that group, because you ultimately won that prize, and you were the first woman to win it. How did it feel getting that?
Again, I was really surprised. I hadn't expected that I would win. But no, it was, I mean, they took a risk with me, I think. And the risk they took was that normally when they award the grant, it's to somebody who's already started a project. And my proposal was to work in the States, a place that I knew very little about, in fact. So it was a completely new project.
Yeah, you chose America. That's a very interesting choice. It's a difficult choice. Almost like, was that some kind of a challenge to yourself that you would go for such an obvious place in a way, and that's a place that's been chosen by so many photographers before you?
Yeah, I mean, there's always a reason to go to America. And even if I think about where I'd been before, the framework that I'd put around America was that of the American dream. And I think the American dream, what the American dream is something that's sort of been sought all over the world. Everyone's in a way looking for their American dream. So the American dream is a metonym. And so it was interesting to me to go and find that American dream.
Yeah, I mean, did you think in a way that choosing America might actually scupper your chances almost, because, you know, their reaction might be, seriously, America?
I don't know. I guess I put in a proposal for something that I actually really wanted to do.
Yeah. But that wasn't the reaction. The reaction was to give you the prize. So you obviously made the right call. And but then you had to go and do it, which mm-hmm. is the kind of scary bit. How were you feeling? Fearful?
Yeah, I was incredibly fearful.
How did you sort of manage all that? How do you manage those things? Because it's not the first time you've been in that position where you had to go and do something where there was pressure on you.
I think it is one of the first times I'd actually been where I felt a huge pressure, because there was a deadline for the work, whereas in the past I'd always worked at my own pace.
Right, I guess up until then, yeah.
My own agenda.
You've been doing your own things, so...
Yeah, so there was the pressure to come up with something. After all, they'd risked giving me the award. They wanted and needed to see something for their money.
Yeah. How did you start to think about how you're going to do it? Or, you know, did you just have to go and then decide?
I think what I really wanted to do with America was to work as, and maybe it's what I've always been doing, but to work as organically as possible. So in a way, one thing leads to another, in the same way as in the Balkans led to Turkey, and Turkey led to Georgia, Ukraine, Bulgaria, Romania, Russia. And so it was a question of working organically, trying to see what I saw, to be, in a way, to try to be confident enough in my seeing and looking.
What happened at the time when you were about to embark on this very big project was that your dad became very ill, and that you've talked a little bit about how that ultimately had an influence on the work. So how did that situation impact on you and on ultimately on the photographs? Because your dad was dying essentially, and you kind of knew that that was the case. It must have been extremely difficult because you had to go and you had to start and you had no choice. It was an extraordinary kind of turn of fate in a way.
I think I did have a choice whether I went or not, but I felt that would have been what my father would probably have respected, and I know my father did respect that decision. But I guess in a way it made me... More vulnerable in a way, and maybe even more sensitive to what was going on around me. I think it probably impacted on the work more than I thought.
Mm-hmm. It was almost there were certain unconscious things that were going on with.
Yeah.
One theme you kind of got onto was this thing with birds. What was the birds thing about?
My dad was a keen amateur ornithologist. And one of the things that happened just before I left was we were all gathered around my dad's bed in the hospital, and my dad sort of commanded us all to tell him what they were up to. And we all sort of blathered away at, you know, what we'd been doing, and I wittered on about having won this prize, and my sister talked about her daughter's degree, and then my brother kind of piped up about he'd seen this bird, and somehow it sort of resonated with my dad, and it seemed like the only thing that kind of felt real in a way. And so birds and bird watching became a sort of theme in my search within America. And my brother still does it, in fact. He sends text messages every week, and usually within those text messages he talks about visiting the spot where my father's ashes are scattered, which is on the bird sanctuary. And he talks about the birds that he's seen, and still does that to this day.
Mm.
And so, yeah, birds became a sort of significant thing for me to follow.
Mm.
And so I sort of chased after these cranes. And I also read this book called The Echo Maker, which mentions these cranes within it. And so, yeah, the birds became a sort of part of my quest, if you like.
How did your dad feel about, you know, what you were doing? And did he have an understanding of you know, how much you achieved in photography?
Yeah, I think so. I think he, I don't know whether he understood necessarily the sort of risks we'd taken, but he, yeah, no, I think he had quite admired what we were doing.
Hmm. So how did the work begin to take shape? You made, I think, three trips. Yeah, what was your process?
We made three trips, two of 3 months and one of 4 months. Each time we made a trip, I would process my film, make contact sheets, digital ones, and make an initial edit of the work. And then when I went back, I had, in a way, an idea of images that I thought worked in telling the or expressing how I felt about America.
But how did you feel? What were the themes that you were sort of pursuing?
I guess I was, again, looking for community. I mean, America's incredibly, it's a vast country. It's not a country, it's a continent.
Mm.
And in a sense, I recognized that I'd sort of bitten off more than I could chew.
Yeah.
In the notion of telling some kind of story about this vast nation with its, you know, its multiplicity of histories and massively complicated. And I guess I recognized that it was, I had a big task.
The images, they have your sort of trademarks. They have a sort of stillness to them. They have the melancholy thing, which in this case, I think we can say that you had actually every right to have for once. You know, it was like you had a genuine, there was that, you were, you know, very much experiencing that. And that does come across. But most of the portraits are of young people, and you know, that's obviously, it was a very deliberate decision. What was that? What was behind that decision?
I think I've always photographed young people. I think even from the very beginning, when I was first becoming a photographer, I photographed what was accessible to me, with my son being with me. And so that actually started off by photographing in school playgrounds, because I could take him with me. But I think somehow it's looking for old souls. I'm interested in old souls.
There's the girl with the tattoo.
The girl with the tattoo.
Which actually says, what does it say?
It actually says, young heart, old soul.
That must have been, she must have been a gift for you then.
Well, I mean, it's funny you should say that, because although she had this very large tattoo on her chest, it's quite interesting that you don't actually read it, because in order to read it would require you to be really staring at her in a very specific way, which I hadn't done.
And also just occurred to me, it's very interesting, I was looking at that picture and thinking, you know, her hair is actually obscuring part of the tattoo. And I was wondering, now, why did Ness not just get her to flick her hair out the way a little bit? You know, I mean, it's pretty obvious it says souls, but that's the word that's obscured. And it started to bug me, or it started to make me wonder whether that was a very deliberate thing or whether I'm just, you know.
No, I mean, it wasn't deliberate at all, because it was only after I'd made her portrait that I allowed myself to ask her about it. I mean, that's the interesting thing about tattoos, is that they're very private but also very public.
But surely you were aware of the fact that you know, you couldn't quite read the whole thing when you looked through the camera at that image.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we should give everything away.
No, exactly. I was just sort of wondering about, you know, how deliberate some of those decisions are. But it does seem to be a book about, you know, I guess the future of America, and those young people are in their hands, essentially.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, because I was just about to stop us and say it's also about the youngness of the nation, the fact that young people are our future, and if we don't look after them, then we're buggered, really.
Yeah, and also they've got a hell of a legacy. Because the responsibility that they've been left with by previous generations is immense.
I mean, they have the weight of the world on their shoulders.
Yeah, and America, you know, being America, is obviously, there's a significance to that. I mean, someone made the point about that book that, you know, why do photographers always go to America? There's so many other countries. And it's like, yeah, but, you know, it's kind of, that implies that all countries are created equal. Obviously, America has a global significance, which is infinitely greater than, say, you know, Belgium or something. Is that part of why you wanted to go to the States?
I mean, I think that in a way, I've sort of worked on the periphery, but what is the periphery? I mean, it's like when you're a child, you believe that your little town is the centre of the universe, and it is. Sure, America is centre stage if you want to look at it globally, but I guess the people I photographed were not necessarily would be considered global players. They're, in a way, perhaps people on the periphery, and perhaps that's what I'm drawn by.
How do you feel the book was received? It did get some very enthusiastic reviews.
Yeah, no, it had some really great reviews, and I'm really grateful for those.
Were you happy with it yourself?
I was actually really happy with it. I mean, it's a beautiful object, I think.
Did a nice job with it.
Yeah, I hope that the work itself is, you know, warrants that degree of quality.
Well, I would say so, but what do I know? In fact, the book sold out, didn't it?
Yeah, it's completely sold out.
I'm assuming you didn't actually make any money from it.
Me?
Yeah.
I think I made about 2,000.
Right, that's good for a couple of years' work. No, I'm being deliberately facetious, but...
No, it's a ridiculous...
It's a ridiculous state of affairs.
State of affairs, but it's more than the money.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it's very prestigious and, you know, publishing a photo book has probably never been about that, but I guess, you know, it gives you a certain kudos, which you could then presumably go and use to to get jobs and income, which you're not particularly into doing. I'm wondering how you manage those austere times, though. George has talked about how, you know, there were times when he wanted to quit. And I'm wondering if you felt the same way at times.
No.
Never.
I never thought of quitting, I don't think. Or maybe it's just sort of false memory. No, I never. Yeah. I don't think I ever considered quitting. I guess it's a question of not really considering it to be a career.
That's kind of, I think, an important point, yeah. I guess there's always a way to earn a living.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not... I guess I'd be willing to do other jobs and have done other jobs to fund...
Your photography.
My photography.
There's also, though, a certain sense that you are finally getting some rewards for many years of hard work.
No, for absolute certain, you know, I'm in a position now where, you know, I can perhaps choose the work that I do.
Hmm. You're also quite busy teaching these days, doing workshops and stuff. Are you enjoying that aspect of being a, you know, a famous photographer?
I mean, as George said, it can be a great energizer.
Mm.
And it is really nice to see people developing and to perhaps feel like you've played a small part of encouraging them. I think I'm not sure whether you can teach the things that are necessary to be a photographer. I think it's something that is within you, and perhaps your role is to just facilitate. I think it's really important not to impose yourself upon them. So I'm not interested in creating pale reflections of Vanessa Winship.
You just had a big retrospective as well in Madrid.
Yeah, it's I suppose it's a mid-career survey.
I was going to say, you know, does it feel like that, you know, you should put your feet up and get a cat or something?
No, absolutely not.
No.
I guess when I think about the other photographers that Matt Frey have shown, it's a sort of combination of sort of people who, you know, it's really their whole career, their whole life's work, and then there's another group of people who are essentially sort of partway through, and I guess I fall into that category of part of the way through. No, I think that the best thing about it, or one of the best things that I'm really grateful for, is that it's sort of allowed me to kind of reflect on what I've done. It's a good time to stop still for a little while, to really consider what direction I think I should be going in.
Mm.
I'd like to go in.
Mm. You've been photographing forests.
Yes.
Is that going to turn into something, do you think?
I've no idea, but I know it's something that I want to do. Some place I want to explore.
Mm.
I mean, I was going to say it's entirely without people, but in fact, the work I did doesn't escape people at all. I've photographed in the forest at Epping. And what I ended up photographing were swings and little bridges and shelters, basically signs of human beings. So it's inescapable.
But you've spent your whole career photographing people, and now it seems like you have started to include a lot of images which are more landscapey, people free. There was quite a few in She Dances on Jackson.
No, in fact, two-thirds of She Dances on Jackson is actually landscape.
Right.
And the whole of the work in Almeria was landscape and without people, but certainly I think all of the landscapes I've made are somehow touched by man.
Mm.
And I'm hoping perhaps this next work will be completely without man.
You're hoping.
I'm hoping.
That's that. I sort of suggest you don't have control over that.
Yeah, well, maybe I don't.
Fair enough. Yeah, maybe you don't. All right. Thanks, Ness.
Thanks, Ben.